All right, my first question is for you. Is you are well known as an actor with movie and television credits such as Baywatch, The Game, NCIS, Los Angeles, Castle, and many more, and most recently, Greenleaf. What prompted you to write a novel, Heart of a Woman, and how did you find time to write it?
Well, my first two books were nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to write a novel, and I actually wrote Heart of a Woman in 2009. Well, actually, it took me 4 years. I started in about 2005. It was published in 2009. And I just, you know, like the long form. I love screenplays, but I like the detail and the attention. And I think the special skill that it takes to write in the novel form. And so I wanted to do that, and I wanted to write a book for a target market, for a constituency, in particular for women who remember the 60s and the 70s and that sort of thing, my peers.
Okay.
Because so much of African American literature for women is sort of directed toward a younger group of women.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much wanted to celebrate that time and women of those, of that era, and our shared memories.
Okay. Now, the plot is crazy. It says it's about a woman who must destroy her husband's young mistress, enlist a murderer to catch a blackmailer in exchange for more than $1 million. She must also seduce a slightly mad man of God. And as you said, the 60s are prominent with Marvin Gaye and Teddy Pendergrass as principal characters. How did you come up with this plot?
You know, it really evolved around the protagonist, Jimmy Stone.
Mm-hmm.
The book describes her as a woman who has the ability to hear the hearts of strangers. As a polio victim, she had polio as a kid, and so she was sort of, there was a summer she was confined to her parents' porch, and over the course of her life, she notices things, she sees things, she sees people, but perhaps most importantly, she hears them.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of her life, people would come to her and find themselves sharing their secrets with her. Ultimately, as an adult, she finds herself working directly for Barry Gordon.
Okay.
As his fixer, as his operative. And so the information that people have given her about themselves over the years, in particular people in the entertainment industry, she's retained all of that. And so she uses that knowledge and that information to fix things that have gone wrong. For example, in the book, a young Motown star gets in trouble with the law, and Barry Gordy dispatches her to fix it so as to preserve Motown's good name. And she does indeed do that. And she fixes it in a very complex way with a number of people, some good, some bad,
mm-hmm.
some powerful, some not so powerful.
Now, I've written a novel before, so I know how difficult it is. Did you have a writing coach to help you, or did you just sit down and write, or how did this come about?
I've been writing all of my adult life. I was a journalist in the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay.
And as a very young man, I used to write for black teen magazines, Ride On, Soul Teen.
Oh, wow.
And there's a radio station in the book that is based on a very famous radio station in Los Angeles, KJLH.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the good fortune to be hired as a copywriter for KJLH in 1980.
Okay, so you're a real writer. I wasn't sure.
I'm sorry?
I said, so you are a real writer. I wasn't sure. I was kind of skeptical.
Yes. So I've been writing for a long time. And you know, just sort of, you know, we sit down and we say, let's try this on. You know, we write commercials, or we write copy, you know, and we write for magazines and newspapers, and we write nonfiction books, and then we sit down and say, I wonder if I can write the great American novel.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, so sat down to write it, and I'm a history buff, and this is, it's historical fiction. So I spent a lot of time in Detroit doing research there, and of course, so much of the book is set in Los Angeles, you know, and I know that territory well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm an E.L. Doctorow fan, so this whole notion of mixing fictional and historical characters has always been very exciting to me.
You said you are a what fan? Can you repeat that?
E.L. Doctorow.
Okay.
You know, he's a very famous writer, and he did that a lot. One of his most famous books is Ragtime.
Okay.
You know, and I think Teddy Roosevelt was a character in the book that, you know, I mean, mixed with his, in fact, it was the movie version of the book was the movie that brought Howard Rollins to star, the late Howard Rollins,
mm-hmm.
who starred, then the book was Ragtime.
Okay.
And he starred on In the Heat of the Night for many years.
Right, I remember him.
Yeah, so that was the book that brought the film version that brought Howard Rollins to prominence, and that was likely the first book of E.L. Doctorow's that I read.
Okay. Now, Heart of a Woman was originally released in 2009, as you said. What prompted you to revamp the novel with an audiobook?
I have wanted for years to sort of merge my skill as a writer with my skill as an actor.
Okay.
And that was really the impetus. Let me now see if I can not only narrate the book, that's the easy part, but let's see if I can voice all of these characters in any kind of a believable way.
Okay. And so we're moving on to Greenleaf, which I love. I know that Greenleaf is filmed here in Atlanta, and that the Greenleaf home is near New Birth Missionary Baptist Church. I believe that's the truth.
Well, yeah, right. The Greenleaf Mansion, yes, is just right around the corner, yes.
And that you also live in Atlanta. And at one point you lived in Hollywood. What prompted you to move to Atlanta and, you know, start your career here and also create your own film actors training studio, Actors Breakthrough?
Well, I had been on a television series for about 7 years, Baywatch.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, I had written a couple of nonfiction books, and that had turned into a lot of speaking opportunities. So I was doing a lot of speaking around the country.
Okay.
And I came to Georgia to speak at a fatherhood conference, and I met some folks who were doing some very innovative work with fathers and families in middle Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to take a sabbatical for 2 years. When I left the series in 97, I went on sabbatical for 2 years and worked in a Head Start program in Macon.
Okay.
Working with this fatherhood program. So that's what brought me to Georgia.
Okay.
So when that was done, it was time to go back to L.A. and start acting again. I just decided to stay in Georgia and commute. There was no work in Georgia at that time. So for years, I commuted in and out of L.A. and New York.
Okay.
To work.
Hmm.
And then as production began to soar here in Georgia, I was traveling a lot less, and that gave me an opportunity to teach here in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a whole heck of a lot of actors here who have my range of experience. There are some, but most, of course, are in L.A. and New York.
Okay.
So, and in particular, as it related to actors of color, it gave me an opportunity to mentor a number of actors and to help move them along in their careers.
Any actors that we recognize?
You know, not any names yet, but plenty of folks who work. In fact, four of my students were on Greenleaf, and I had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
Because they had secured their own agents and auditioned and booked. And we have dozens of actors on all kinds of shows. From Atlanta to Sleepy Hollow. We just had an actor who finished a movie with The Rock.
Okay.
So we're very excited and very proud that we have started a number of actors in the business, you know, trained them, and they've studied very hard, and now they're working professionally.
And you're still part of this studio, the training studio?
I teach for 6 hours every Saturday.
Okay, okay.
And we have other instructors and things, but I teach at the master level every Saturday from about noon to 5 or 6.
Okay. Now, Robert Mac MacCready is the ultimate villain, and you portray him masterfully. Is there any part, you're welcome, is there any part of Mac that you identify with, and what is your inspiration for portraying him?
Well, in the second season, I identify with Mac's loneliness, and I'll tell you what I mean. Because Mac has been found out,
mm-hmm.
and he's estranged from the family, he's very lonely. His family's family, believe it or not, is very important to Mac.
Mm-hmm.
The church is very important to Mac, and so Mac is estranged from both the church and the family. Now, because Mac is estranged, that means that I'm also separated from my acting family,
okay.
Lynn and Keith, because in the second season, really, the only actor I did work with is Merle, and that's wonderful, and then some of the wonderful guest stars that we have, but, you know, I don't get to, you know, see and work with, you know, some of these other folks that I love so much, Lamont and Kim and, you know, Deborah Joy Winans and all those folks. I hardly see them. So Mac and I, we're both lonely.
Okay.
In that regard.
Okay.
And I think, you know, but one of the things I teach is that when we take on characters whose values we don't share,
mm-hmm.
we tend to want to make those characters very different than ourselves, to think of those characters as being very different. But here's the truth. Matt is obsessed with his abusive behavior. He's obsessed with 13, 14, 15-year-old girls. Wholly inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So when you approach a character like Mac, I think the first thing you have to do is say, what do we have in common? Well, you know what? I'm not obsessed with 13, 14, 15-year-old girls, but I've been obsessed, and I know what obsession is.
Okay.
I've been obsessed with some grown women. You know what I mean? And as a much younger man, you know, sort of out there dating and partying, certainly on occasion have been less than honest, less than forthcoming about what my intentions were, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm not a perfect guy. So I have to look at, as much as I want Matt to be, you know, 180 degrees different, we have some things in common. Or I've had some things in common. So when you approach a character, because you cannot portray a character you don't understand, and you can't portray a character who you wholly dislike. It's impossible to step into that character's life unless that character is self-hating, and Mac is not self-hating. Sometimes he is, but most of the time he is not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so one has to come to understand Mac. That doesn't mean approve of, but to understand and to be able to identify the rationalizations that he uses in order to engage guilt-free in his predatory behavior.
Hmm. Now, he had, for part of the season, what I call an age-appropriate beard in Lorraine. So, did you mean when he cursed her out and called her bottom shelf and off-brand? I know that was supposed to be serious, but did you find that funny at all? I found it funny, but I know it wasn't supposed to be, but I'm just curious.
I mean, I think it's funny in its audacity.
Okay.
I mean, because what can you do but laugh? Because it's so horrible. And let me tell you, I have to say this. You see, this is why I love writers. Now, when I first got the script, I looked at it, and I said, oh my goodness, I can't say this. This is horrible. See, left to me, the actor, if you had said, okay, Greg Allen, here's a moment, you've got to put this lady in her place, I'd have come up with some mundane curse words and this and that. Yeah. You know what I mean? But this writer is so brilliant that they totally sidestep the nasty language and come up with something so horrible. Bottom shelf? Off brand? that when I first read it, I said, I can't see this. Oh, my God, I can't see this. I said to my lady, I said, girl, read this. She can't see that. She said, you can't say that. I said, I know I can't say that. But, you know, that's why I love writers. So innovative. And it is. I don't think, I think maybe you've heard Matt curse once.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Matt curses. He's a good Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So mm-hmm. no, he don't curse much. So he would say something like that. And that's what makes him even all the more creepy. Because he's a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an abuser. But yet he finds cursing perhaps to be a little beyond the pain. Isn't that some madness?
Well, that leads to my next question, because he is a respectable child molester. So I was wondering, how do you research being a respectable child molester? He's not someone that you're going to see in the alleyway, and he's not going to, you know, jump on you. He's going to take you through some changes until, you know, he finally then attacks you.
Well, this speaks to the courage of the producers, because people can't molest children most of the time unless they are respectable.
Mm-hmm.
90% of child molesters are very respectable. That's how they're able to do it. Sometimes I ask my acting students, how is it that a serial killer is able to kill serially? And they come up with all kinds of things. But the truth is, because he doesn't seem to be a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he's not just snatching people and banging people over the head. Oprah says that she wanted to show the audience that abusers are seducers. And mm-hmm. and that's what she's done. And by extension, that's what the producers and writers have done. So that is the truth, and that should forewarn viewers not to see the, you know, the boogeyman under every bush, but to understand that sometimes those people we entrust our children to, those folks have positioned themselves in those respectable places in order to be able to hurt children.
Now, I don't think you're going to be able to answer any of these questions, but I'll just, you know, shoot them off in rapid fire for next Tuesday and Wednesday. Is Mac dead? Will he ever admit to molesting Faith? Did Mac see his sister, Lady May, molested by their father? And if you can't answer those questions, then what can we expect in the second half of season two?
Well, remember, in the first half of season two, in episode 8, he did admit, as he was choking Grace, he said, they wanted it. I didn't do anything they didn't want me to do.
Hmm.
So he did admit.
Okay.
To essentially all of his crimes. As to whether he will live or die, I will say this to you. Every goodbye ain't gone.
Okay. And every shut eye ain't closed, okay.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Well, that's all the questions I have for you. I did have like a side question. How did you get your name? It's such a unique name.
Well, I'll tell you, with the Screen Actors Guild, no two actors can have the same name.
Okay.
So when I joined the union, there was already a Gregory Williams.
Okay.
So I hyphenated my middle to my last. My middle name is Allen. So I became Gregory Allen hyphen Williams. So that was neat for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because all my life being a Williams, I had been at the bottom of the list.
Mm-hmm.
So being Allen Williams would be at the top of the list.
Oh, then, okay, okay.
Then
okay.
Unfortunately, that actor passed away in the early 90s. And so then I could just be Gregory Williams, but instead, because I had always been Gregory Allen Williams, I pushed my middle name to the first name.
Okay.
And so the name didn't change. The structure of it changed, but not the name. I was still Greg Allen Williams. And I think what really prompted me to do that, I had a producer named Gregory Bonin, who was one of the creators and producers of Baywatch, And he always called me Greg Allen. Hmm. Always.
Okay.
And so when the other Greg Williams died, I said, I guess I'll stay Greg Allen, and I'll just move my middle to the first. And there you've got two first names.
Okay. Simple enough.